Our room is full again, which means we are ready for the next talk. We solved our video emergency thanks to the amazing help of the FOSDEM team. I have here Alvar, who is going to talk about a very interesting subject. He says it isn't interesting in itself, but I disagree, because privilege separation is super difficult, super amazing. It's a problem usually done in C, not in Go. But we have an expert today who's going to prove us wrong. Round of applause.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, you can hear me. My name is Alvar. Thanks for the nice introduction. And I want to talk about privilege separation in Go. So who am I? As said, doesn't really matter. I'm just a white guy in tech talking about privileges today. So as any tech talk, I start with an obligatory XKCD comic, because that's how you do it, I heard. This one is XKCD 1200 authorization, and it shows a nice picture about the user account. And this user account has access to like everything except the admin account. So your user can access the emails, the pictures, the belovings, whatever. So we start with some kind of implicit definition of privileges. But how does it reflect in code? Code on most POSIX, like operating systems, so I just stick to this topic because everything else is not my domain, runs as a user. So code runs with user privileges, and to just show it, I just try to find my cursor here. So we have this, come on. Oh, great success. So we have this wonderful code, and as we saw just, it ran as my user, as you see, running as Alvar. So we know who does it, and we have privileges as my user has. My user has the privileges to open the file, as we see in the OS open. So what can else the code with running my privileges do? So we can get a bit stupid here, because we have code running, so is this a good idea? Let's find out. Oh no, I got pawned by my presentation. So because we have code here, the code is running with my user privileges, the code may do something stupid and leak my credentials, like in this incident. But okay, this was all fun and games, but how is it in the real life? I mean, in the real life, no one would do something stupid as have a shell open where anybody could do remote code execution. Well, in the good case. In the reality, also in the Go domain, we have lots of lines of code. We include dependencies, those are including dependencies as well. And as most in this room, when a dependabot alert comes in, say a dependency XYZ was updated, do we want to, yeah, it's fine. So maybe for a patch release, there were some 7,000 lines of change. I don't know what it does. So my code is running and maybe do some things I don't want it to do. So, and this is all just for the good case. Maybe you remember the XZ incident a while back. There are also backdoors, and just because none were found in the Go domain doesn't mean there aren't any. So, for myself, I realized I'm unable to write secure code. I fail at it, and I think down in our heart most of us would fail. So I would say to just go down, that my code only does what is really, only can do what's really necessary. So this is like privileges. As we've seen, the code before could access my private key. Does my presentation to know my private key? I don't think so. So there was once an analogy I heard. It was about a self-chaining werewolf, like the people who got the werewolf chains himself before he turns and back. And so maybe is it possible to do with code? Obviously, question. Yes, I'm going to talk about it today. So, as in most things, we have an API for that, and if I say one API, it's like hundreds. We have some defined by POSIX, so they're available in Linux, the BSDs, and other similar operating systems. And we have OS specifics, and I'm going to talk a bit about both today. At OS specific, I'm going to limit on Linux, because I think it affects most people in the rooms. I may say a thing about two about OpenBSD, but I think time is short. But before actually showing code, talking about, we have to think about the structure of our code. Because if we want to restrict permissions, we may have to redesign the architecture of our code. Like first we start with all the privileges that are possible, and then we try to go down like a cane. And every time we go down, this is like a barrier. So we drop some privileges, and we drop them for good. So, for example, we say, at first, we have to read the configuration file of our software because there's everything configured. So we still need the privilege to read files. Then after we have it done, we can say, no, we don't need to read files anymore, and then this is gone, and so on. And at least we maybe run with so little privileges so that when our software has a bug, it's not bad. And I'm saying when, not if. So, three simple points. Privilege task, drop privileges, that's good, okay. So let's start with the good old way, which works on everything POSIX. And this is, I think most have heard about it, shrouding the code. Shrouding and then switching user privileges. This is the old way, and it has some things that aren't so great, but we can get quite far with it. Here I've shown three code boxes. The first, to show you where the imports are from, that's the extended Unix package, which has the syscalls. It differs from operating system on architecture to architecture. So, but this is all almost POSIX, so this should work on like everything except Windows. I don't care about Windows. So at first, we see how to change the root. And the change root means, at first, our program can see everything the root file system sees. And then, but we can say, no, our root shouldn't be the root anymore. We want to run under this directory. And var empty is one standard directory for that. It should be empty. Otherwise, yeah, where's the fun? So we can go into it, and our code now lives in this directory. But shroot isn't actually a security mechanism, so we have to also drop user rights. And so here we have set groups. So we aren't the group of our user anymore, but only one group. This group shouldn't be allowed to do anything, and the same for the user. This is a set REST UID, because at first we have set UID, but it is effective UID, and so on. I don't want to go into details, but that's actually how you switch user rights. The downside is only the root user can do it. So to execute this, you already need extended privileges. That's a downside, and it was made better with operating specific libraries I get to later on. So how to actually use this? I marked the blocks in bold, which I showed before, because otherwise it wouldn't fit on the slide. So at first, I would say show who we are and what can we do. Then I looked up our demo user. This is a user which has any rights, where we're going to. Then we switch our root and switch our user. So effectively, at the first step, we shouldn't be able to see any files anymore, but we are still a privileged user, and we could theoretically break out. And otherwise, at last, we are then a user who can't do anything, and our code can at least cannot access our private key anymore. So to show it, okay. At first, we've seen a whole file system. And in the end, we are running as user 1001, and we don't see anything. And yes, my presentations are running as a root user. So, as we see, as I said earlier, having to start your application at root isn't always the best thing to do, because, for example, you have a command line application where you don't want to have a root user. So there are more modern APIs to restrict file access, and this is this is Linux only, and this is the landlock API. It's quite new in the kernel, but I think on most of your laptops, if they're on a Linux device, they should be already available. And landlock is a nice API to restrict both file systems.